wanted to take a brief excursus to address something that I think is particularly urgent in our own day and age, and that is the continuing loss of the Lord's Day, and to encourage Christians that this is something that we need to recover, and we need to understand why it is so important. But before we go to the Word of the Lord, let's go to the Lord of the Word and ask for His blessing. Please join me. God, our Father, I do pray now, Lord, that as we come to this weighty subject of the Lord's Day, I pray, O Lord, that You would help us to understand it better and to apply it, that we would see, O Lord, the practical and the spiritual benefits of it, and we would understand what the cost of losing the Lord's Day would be in our generation, O Lord, what the effects would be in this nation, and how, O Lord, it would affect us as Christians. Help us, O Lord, clearly to see all the ways that You have taken care of us, all the ways that You have provided for our spiritual needs. Help me, O Lord, to share this with Your people. I pray, O Lord, that You would give me the words that I need to speak. I pray I would not go astray to the left or to the right. I pray, O Lord, that with clarity I would open up to them merely what Your commandments are and how they are a great blessing to Your people when they are used aright. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Isaiah chapter 58, verses 13 and 14. This is the word of the Lord to His people in every age. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and shall honor Him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth, and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. I'm sure all of you, if you've grown up in the United States, are very familiar with the Save the Blank bumper stickers. You see them all over the place. You see Save the Blank license plates these days. Save the whales. Save the manatees. Save Tibet. They even get as general as Save the Planet. Okay? And my personal favorite, and the only one I've ever actually considered putting on my car, is Save the Baby Humans. Thought that was a particularly apt use of the save the genre. But what are all of these save the fill-in-the-blank bumper stickers aiming at? What are they all about? Well, they imply, obviously, that something, the thing that needs to be saved, is under attack. That it is in danger of being wiped out. And in the case of certain species of animals, the idea is that if we don't act soon, if we don't act quickly to conserve them, they'll be gone forever. They'll become extinct. We call that extinction. And so the bumper sticker is trying to convince you that the thing or the species in question is inherently valuable and that their extinction would be a bad thing. That's something that we need to remember. Nobody puts, for instance, save the dust bunnies on the back of their car, or, for instance, save the big line at the DMV, okay? These are things that we don't consider valuable. And who of us wouldn't want to get rid of something like standing in line? These are things that we'd be better off without. But we figure whales are valuable, and we want to preserve them. The bumper sticker wants to convince us, therefore, to do something while there is still time, or something good and perhaps even precious will be lost to us forever. Well, I want to suggest to you, brothers and sisters, and the reason that I'm coming before you this morning is to try to convince you that there is something of great value. Great value that is rapidly becoming extinct in our society, and that it is well past the time that we should have acted to conserve it. And it is something that you would think that Christians of all people would want most to conserve, would treasure, as a matter of fact. But in point of fact, I fear it is something that we, as much as unbelievers, are culpable for making extinct. And I'm not talking about marriage here. I am, in fact, talking about the Lord's Day. I'm talking about the Christian Sabbath. I mean, of course, not just Sunday as another day of the week, like Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. I'm talking about Sunday as a holy day. Sunday as that one day in seven set aside exclusively for you to rest upon, to worship upon, a day in which we are supposed to be doing only those duties of piety and mercy and necessity that the Lord has set before us to be performed. And I think that the evidence for its extinction, if you stop to consider, is being piled up all around us. We see it every day. You see signs on retail businesses. One of the most common ones I see these days is the proud proclamation, "Now open Sunday." As Joy and I were going out to eat at a restaurant, Mexican restaurant, there it was in front of us as we were walking in. And I'm sure most people looked at it and went, "Oh, good." And we looked at it and went, "Oh, no." That's how we saw it. You see it not only, though, in stores that are suddenly now open Sunday. You see it, for instance, in youth league games that are increasingly scheduled on Sunday morning. Little League or Pee Wee football or whatever it is. Soccer. You see it in the demands made by more and more employers on their employees to be at work on Sunday. You see it in the fact that Sunday is now the second busiest day of the week for shopping. You see it in how normal it is, for instance, to schedule major sporting events or big TV specials on a Sunday. You see it in the way that so many factories have switched over to a 7-day continuous operation so that we have a shift that is in there on Sunday. Or the fact that the few blue laws still on the books that prevent commerce or the selling of certain things like alcohol are all gradually being struck down. Very few of them remain. Interestingly enough, one of the comments I was reading about the history of blue laws and how few of them, there are no blue laws, for instance, left in Fayetteville or Cumberland, although there once were. And it was by referendum I found out that they were struck down. The interesting thing is that even the critics saw why they were happening. One person commenting on the battle over the blue laws, and this is a secular commentator, said, "You see it in the switch over to a 7-day, commenting on the battle, "Both sides agree it's a further indication that Sunday is becoming just an ordinary day." And so that's what the law is acknowledging. It's just an ordinary day. Now, kids, you probably already know this, and I've been talking about extinction. Well, it's often the case when an animal is becoming extinct that animal that's becoming extinct was once very, very common. Okay. For instance, the early explorers of the American West, as they went out to the Great Plains, they were just amazed because they saw herds and herds of buffalo. One explorer described it. He said, "It was like an unbroken sea of buffalo stretching onto the horizon and then far beyond it." When America was first settled, buffalo were the most numerous single species of large wild mammal on Earth. If you can believe it. That is how numerous these were. And yet, by the end of the 19th century, that once most numerous animal was almost totally extinct. It had been hunted to the point where there were only a few tiny, pitifully small herds left by the beginning of the early 20th century. And it took massive attempts to preserve them and build them up to continue the buffalo as a species. And somebody looking at one of these tiny little herds at the beginning of the 20th century would have had to have said, you know, that the idea that once there were millions, a sea of buffalo stretching to the horizon, they would have looked at that and said, "That's ridiculous. That's outrageous. How could that be? I mean, I only see one or two here. This is millions? A sea?" Well, I want to suggest to you, brothers and sisters, that the same is actually true of the Lord's Day here in America. The modern observer, as he looks at the pitiful state of Lord's Day observance today, would probably be astounded, I mean absolutely astounded, at exactly how common Lord's Day observance in America once was. I've spoken to people in this congregation, for instance, who can remember as children or young adults growing up that the shops weren't open. You couldn't go out and buy a hot dog anywhere in Fayetteville at one point in time. The only businesses that were still open on Sunday were the essential businesses. Yeah, the U.S. Army had to keep operating. The hospital had to keep operating. The power stations had to keep operating. But everything else tended to be shut on the Lord's Day. They were closed. And how things gradually changed and how that's now accelerating. But brothers and sisters, it really was once the case that here in America, shops and bars and restaurants didn't open on Sunday. Non-essential businesses didn't operate. Sporting events were not held. Christians did not immediately pile out of the church and go to Sunday brunch. Didn't happen. You went home after church. You didn't go to a restaurant. One of the great, it seems almost impossible to believe, but one of the great debates held in Congress in the 19th century was over the issue of whether the mail should move on Sunday, not be delivered. Whether the mail should just move on Sunday or whether that was a violation of the Lord's Day. Eventually, one group prevailed. They said, look, military messages are being transferred in this mail and it has to keep moving on Sunday. Okay, it's a matter of national security. But it wasn't simply a pragmatic, well, it would be good to just keep the mail going. That was an issue of real concern to them. Let me give you one of the early laws of North Carolina. And, I mean, reading this, we could have lifted this law from our confessions of faith as they were originally drafted. This is one of the laws from the early days of North Carolina. Whereas in well-regulated governments, effectual care is always taken that the day set aside for public worship be observed and kept holy, and to suppress vice and immorality, wherefore be it enacted that all and every person and persons whatsoever shall on the Lord's Day, commonly called Sunday, carefully apply themselves to the duties of religion and piety, and that no tradesman, artisan, planter, laborer, or other person whatsoever shall upon the land or water do or exercise any labor, business, or work of their ordinary calling, works of charity and necessity only excepted, nor employ themselves either in hunting, fishing, or fowling. Can you imagine that at one time going hunting on Sunday in North Carolina or fishing was against the law? But that's it. Fowling, nor use any game, sport, or play on the Lord's Day aforesaid, or any part thereof, upon pain that every person, so offending, being of the age of 14 years and upwards, shall forfeit and pay the sum of 10 shillings. And at the time when this was enacted, that was a monstrous amount of money. They took it very, very seriously. Now, you may be tempted at this point to say, well, the fact that something was once common is not an argument that it should be preserved today, all right? There were many things that were common in America in the 19th century that we have no zeal for preserving. Hoop skirts, or the 17th century, putting people in stocks. We have no desire to preserve those particular traditions, as useful as they might be today. We still don't want them. So I would agree with you in that. Brothers and sisters, I would say that merely because something was once a tradition in the United States doesn't mean it should be retained and practiced by us. And even if it is being practiced currently, okay, that it is a current tradition of ours, that is no argument that Christians should practice it. Is doesn't imply ought. Merely because something is being done doesn't say necessarily that it should be done. And besides, you all know that Christians cannot be compelled to observe the traditions of men and practice them simply because they are the traditions of men, even if they're useful. Jesus himself instructed the church in Matthew 28:18 that we should teach his disciples to observe all things that I have commanded you. He did not say go out into the world and teach all men to observe your traditions and innovations. But you see, brothers and sisters, this is vitally important. The observance of the Lord's Day is not a tradition of men. The observance of the Lord's Day is a biblical commandment of the Lord of the Sabbath. And that Christian Sabbath, and this is something that most people don't even realize, the Christian Sabbath is something that all the Protestant denominations of the United States agreed upon. They all agreed that we should be observing the Lord's Day and keeping it holy. I mean... Proving, in one sense, the Lord's Day from our own confessions of faith, that I could look from the back of this book, is too easy. All right, the Westminster Confession and the Westminster Larger and Shorter Catechisms both talk about the Lord's Day. You as Presbyterians probably know that already, or those of you who are Presbyterians, I shouldn't presume, probably know that already. But this was also true of Congregationalists. It was true of Baptists. It was true of almost all the denominations. In fact, let me give you a quote from a Baptist Confession of Faith, one of the more common ones, the New Hampshire Baptist Confession of Faith of 1833. This is what it says. Section 15. Of the Christian Sabbath, we believe that the first day of the week is the Lord's Day, or Christian Sabbath, and is to be kept sacred to religious purposes, by abstaining from all secular labor and sinful recreations, by the devout observance of all the means of grace, both private and public, and by preparation for that rest that remaineth for the people of God. And all of those ideas are found in our own confessions of faith, and in the confessions of faith like the Declaration of the Savoy Conference that was adopted by the Congregationalists. Most denominations understood that this was what the Bible is teaching. But I don't want to just show you our confessions, okay, our constitutional documents. I want to show you this briefly from Scripture, all right? Now, I want to show you why, therefore, the London Baptist Confession, the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, they're exactly right in what they say about the Sabbath. And to show you, after that, how to keep the Sabbath and what the blessings of the Sabbath are, and then to warn you individually, corporately, as members of this nation, what the results of our not keeping the Lord's Day holy will ultimately be. And I want to show you how grievous, truly, they are. Now, I realize that many Christians, and this is really a teaching that's only common to the 20th century, it came out of dispensationalism, many of them have been taught that the Sabbath, and that word means cessation or resting, was a Jewish ceremonial law, and that it is not something that should be applied to Christians. It is something like the temple sacrifices that were done away with when Christ fulfilled the ceremonial law, and therefore it is not binding on Christians. Well, brothers and sisters, that simply is not true. It is not true. The Sabbath, like marriage, was something that was instituted at creation. It goes all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, Genesis 2:3. In there, we see the great divine example of God doing the work of creation for 6 days and resting on the seventh. Now, our God is almighty. He is omnipotent. He could have created the universe and everything in it instantly, in a second. He could have done it however he wanted to. He could have done it over the process of just one day, but he didn't. He did it over the process of 6 days and then rested on the seventh. For what reason? The answer is to set a pattern for us that every seventh day should be a day of rest and worship. Now we see that also that Moses makes reference to observing the Sabbath in Exodus 16. When the manna is first given. This is long before they arrive at Sinai, before they are given the law, okay, either in the Ten Commandments or the other ceremonial and judicial laws. Before the Israelites ever reached Sinai, they received that particular commandment, and it was simply a reiteration of that which they already had, the Sabbath commandment going back to creation. But when they did get to Sinai, they were given it again, not as part of the ceremonial laws, not as part of the judicial laws, but part of the Decalogue, part of the Ten Commandments. The Sabbath commandment, the Lord's Day commandment, is number 4. That is commandment number 4. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Exodus 20. I just want you to see the commandment. Starting with verse 8. There we remember. We read, rather, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. He created over that 7-day period, or rather he created over a 6-day period and then rested on the seventh to set a pattern. And the commandment itself appeals back to that pattern. And so it is given to us as part of the moral law, those laws written by the finger of God and not part of the ceremonial law. And certainly we don't think that any of the other laws of the Decalogue have passed away. We don't believe that just because we're New Testament Christians, for instance, that now stealing or adultery or blasphemy is suddenly okay. These commandments are perpetual because they are a perpetually binding expression of the holiness of God. We don't have 9 commandments, if I can put it that way. We have 10. Of course, these days it's almost the 10 suggestions, but that's not the case. These are the moral law that were given to us by God. And we're told in the New Testament that part of the reason that we were given the moral law was to convict men, and Paul is very clear on this point, to convict all men, Gentiles and Jews, alike of sin. Now, brothers and sisters, how could the fourth commandment be of any use in convicting of sin if it was no longer in force? You can't break what's not in force. What about the New Testament? Well, in the New Testament, we see Jesus identifying himself, saying, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. Now, he does remove and condemn all of the sinful additions, those hundreds of additions that the Pharisees had put upon the Lord's Day, where they had taken away its original use, and it was given to us by God to be a blessing, a day of rest, a day of peace. And they had taken it and they had made it into a burden by adding all of these accretions. And it was no longer for men. Men had become servants of the Sabbath. The direction had changed entirely. And so he clears away all of that muck and that filth. And he tells us, this is for my Father. It's a gift. It was made for man. It was intended by him to be a gift, a blessing to you. Now, originally, obviously, the Sabbath was the seventh day of the week. It was Saturday. And it pointed to the work of creation. But by completing the work of redemption or recreation and rising again on the first day, Jesus forever changed the Sabbath to the first day of the week. That is Sunday. That is why Christians met to celebrate the resurrection not just once a year on Easter, but they met every week in worship on the first day of the week. And why they called that day, as John did in Revelation 1:10, the Lord's Day. And it is a memorial, an abiding memorial, that points not only forward, as I said, but backwards. As Hebrews 4:9 tells us, there remains a Sabbath or a rest for the people of God, and that rest is the beginning of the eternal Sabbath that we will all as Christians enjoy when we enter into heaven. What is the Sabbath, therefore, intended to be for you? Well, it's intended to be a day of blessing. It's intended to be a day of rest. It's a day where we should all be experiencing the true joy of the resurrection, of knowing that we have been redeemed at the cost of Jesus Christ. And it should also be something that gives us joy as we look forward to our own resurrection on a regular weekly basis. How, therefore, should we keep the Sabbath? Well, the verses that we read in the beginning here in Isaiah 58 explain that process in detail. Now, I'm not going to point out every single bit and piece. I'm not going to say, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, because I could spend all day doing that. I want to just outline the way these verses open it up for us. In Exodus 58:13, the first thing they say is that we should turn away our foot from it. Now, what does that mean? That means we treat the whole day like holy ground. We do not trample on the Sabbath. We do not profane its sanctity. You remember, as Moses came into the presence of God, he said, Moses, put off your shoe because the land or the place that you're standing is holy ground. And it wasn't because Mount Sinai had been set apart as a particular sanctuary, but it was because God was present there. We meet with God, brothers and sisters, on the Sabbath day, on the Lord's day. And therefore, there is a particular sanctity to it. We should put the shoes off of our foot and not profane it, therefore. We turn our foot away when we do not do what pleases us, when we do not do what seems good in our eyes, but rather when we do, and here I don't want you to misunderstand what this says. When Isaiah says, when we don't do that which pleases us, he's not saying that therefore we should spend the Sabbath doing those things that don't please us. He says we should spend the day not doing the things that don't please God. We should spend the day doing the things that please God, not necessarily us. We should think about the Lord's Day not as a day of drudgery, but as a day of delight. It is a holy day. It is the Lord's Day, and we are to honor it as such, and not by doing our own pleasure. And brothers and sisters, when it says not by doing your own pleasure, that doesn't mean not doing your own business, not going to work as you normally would. It means your recreation. Your worldly recreation, your commerce. And it means also our words. We can and do. And I've been as guilty of this as anybody else, of profaning the Lord's Day by our idle talk, of emptying it of all of its meaning, by forgetting God in the way that we speak, in what we discuss. We may not work on the Lord's Day, but do we spend the entire Lord's Day talking about work? We may not play on the Lord's Day, but do we spend the entire Lord's Day talking about play? That is often the case. As E.J. Young puts it, what is mentioned tends to draw the heart away from God to the consideration of one's own occupations. That's when we're not speaking of the Lord's Day, speaking on the Lord's Day in a holy manner. Now, if you do keep the Lord's Day this way, all right, if you do keep it by turning your foot aside, by not doing your own pleasure, but by doing that which the Lord has commanded, what does he say? He himself promises with his own mouth that it will become a delight to you, that it will bless you, that it will be a means of grace to you. And I tell you this, brothers and sisters, and I wish. Now, I can't taste and see for all of you. But I tell you this, I have never encountered a family that has really started keeping the Lord's Day holy that has not experienced that day as a positive blessing to them, has not seen the benefits of it in their family, in their piety, in their love of God, in the grace that the Lord gives to them through it. And I tell you this, it is often simply the case that people are robbing themselves of that blessing. I don't want to beat you up with the Sabbath. I want to encourage you with the Sabbath. I want to tell you that if you do, as a family, begin to really strive to keep this Lord's Day holy, it will be such a blessing to you. And it breaks my heart when I see people who are seeking blessings through commerce and recreation and basically through the world and never getting them. Never getting anything except just another day. Sunday is like Tuesday. And I don't get much blessing on Tuesday, I must tell you. So why is such a blessed institution, okay, if it is a day of blessing, why is it disappearing from our society? Well, simply put, it is because the world, the flesh, and the devil all hate the Lord's Day. They despise it. And as they expunge it, what are they doing? They are removing one of the most constant and visible and reoccurring reminders of the resurrection, of redemption, and of Christian religion from our society. Christians go crazy. They go literally ape over the expunging of Christmas and Easter. But they bid sayonara to the Lord's Day a long time ago. And what is more constant? Easter and Christmas come up once a year each. The Lord's Day is every week. And we have let it go. Now, the world knows that if they can expunge the Lord's Day entirely, they will have dealt quite a blow to Christianity. Not a mortal blow. Nothing will destroy it. But let me show you what I mean. And by this, I want you to think about the practice of corporate worship. What we're doing right now, what you're all doing together, is assembling to worship the Lord on a particular day. How many of you have been asked by an employer at some point to work and non-essential work on the Lord's Day, by a show of hands? How many of you have been asked by your employer to work on the Lord's Day? Okay. It is becoming increasingly common. I myself was told not just to come in and work on Sunday when I was working in retail, but when I was doing IT, whenever there was a server patch, the day they suggested, for instance, was Sunday. Come in on Sunday. You get that done then. And the trend these days, increasingly, this is the corporate way, is to assign random days off. Okay? Everybody doesn't get Saturday and Sunday off. They may get 2 days off, but those days are whatever days the company sees fit throughout the week. Tuesday and Thursday, Tuesday and Saturday, Wednesday and whatever. But not one constantly reoccurring day of the week. Not Sunday. Now let me ask you this. If that becomes the trend, not just in, and let me tell you, in retail, in the food services industry, in shopping and so on, you can't get a job these days almost without being willing to say, I will come in and work on Sunday, all right? And you have no legal protections, all right? There's nothing that stops you and allows you to say, I will not work on Sunday, I have a legal right not to, you have to employ me anyway. Often Christians are forced to make a sacrifice. Job because I won't work on Sunday. But let's say that the world succeeds and it removes the importance of Sunday and it becomes, excuse me, just another day. When are Christians going to worship? When are we going to get together? Let me ask you this. If you have randomly sprinkled days off throughout the week, what are we going to do? We're going to assemble every day? I'll meet with a small group that's free on Monday. Then I'll meet with a small group that's free on Tuesday. Then I'll meet with a small group that's free on Wednesday. Then I'll meet with a small group that's free on Thursday or on Friday and Saturday. And then I'll have my heart attack on Sunday. Because I've just preached and given a Lord's Day worship service every single day of the week. Obviously, that's impossible. What's more common? That we simply move worship away. It becomes, I'll get to it when I can. If I can. I can't get to it. So I won't. Obviously, what is happening is that as the Lord's Day disappears, so do the visible expressions of Christianity within our society. Now, R.L. Dabney pointed this out many years ago. I'm not going to read the entire Sabbath meditation here. Just read the portion in bold. He says this, "When it is made to appear that this day is the bulwark of practical religion in the world, that its proper observance everywhere goes hand in hand with piety and the true worship of God, that where there is no Sabbath, there is no Christianity. It becomes an impossible supposition that God would make the institution temporary. Where there is no Sabbath, there is no Christianity. And that has been the case. Where the Lord's Day is expunged totally from the society, inevitably Christianity, as a corporate expression of faith, follows after it. Now, even secular critics acknowledge the detrimental effects of losing the Lord's Day. The lifting of blue laws, wrote one, in their own way, seems to de-emphasize religion as well as close family community and neighborhood ties. That's a professor at a university. He says it's part of the broader social and cultural trend towards isolation, which is absolutely true. One critic, I was amazed by this, he actually acknowledged the good things about it and then said it was good that they were going away. He said this, the Sabbath was a time for religion, for family, to renew kinship bonds. But religion isn't static in this country. Sunday, Christmas, Easter, these aren't necessarily the days of celebration for everybody anymore. The repeals show how dynamic our society is and how much things change. And he was saying that's a good thing. We've lost that time for kinship. We've lost that time for family. We've lost that time for religion. But that's a good thing that it's gone away. I mean, it's crazy. Now, as the Lord's Day disappears, we, you and I, are hastening the departure of religion. And I say this, you and I, and I'm not excusing ministers, are hastening the departure of Christianity as we see the departure of the Lord's Day. And how do you do that? Now you may say, well look, Andy, I don't work on Sunday. I am not hastening the departure of the Lord's Day in that sense. But I would say, look to your habits and ask, are you encouraging the process in other ways? You remember that when the initial commandment was given, it didn't merely say, don't you work yourself. It said, don't make others work. Don't make the members of your family work. Don't make the servants work on the Lord's Day. How do you do it then? Well, how do we encourage the death of the Lord's Day, even when we're not working ourselves? When you go out to eat and shop today, what are you doing? You may not be working yourself. You may view it as your day off, but you are forcing others to work. Do you think that the waitress comes and delivers your meal as an act of piety or necessity or mercy? She's being paid to put the plate in front of you. And then you give her a tip and encourage her for working on the Lord's Day. What about other things? Have you considered the companies that do make the decision not to open on Sunday? There's a chain, for instance, Chick-fil-A, makes the decision not to open on Sunday. When you go to Burger King on Sunday, you encourage their competition. And people within that organization say, look, we made the right decision. Chick-fil-A made the wrong decision. We're making greater profits. You're actually encouraging that process. If no Christian ate or shopped on a Sunday, do you think that the stores would stay open? It would become a deader shopping day than Monday. I had a restaurant owner in our last church sprang up and he loudly declaimed to the Christian community saying, you know, you get out of your worship on Sunday and you come rushing off to the restaurant where I work at and my manager makes me stay in because he knows there's going to be a crowd of a mighty host of Christians descending upon the restaurant. And so he says to me, you work and my Lord's Day is blown out of the water by your Lord's Day. Is that fair? Is that right? Or what about if we don't eat or shop? When we take our kids to sporting events, we hasten the extinction of the Lord's Day. Recently, we as a family were crushed that our daughter's dance recital, and she's doing ballet and tap, has been scheduled for Sunday. And we had to tell her, honey, you're not going to be going to that. And it wasn't scheduled by a non-Christian. Her dance classes are run by a Christian. This is something the Christian community is doing. And so it has been my purpose today to try to encourage you, to convince you. I've been trying just standing up here. I want to be a little bumper sticker. Save our Sundays. Because when they're gone, brothers and sisters, you won't be able to assemble here. Not unless you do it very, very late or very, very early, like the early Christians did. The Romans didn't regard Sunday as holy until Constantine made it the Lord's Day by official decree within the empire. And so as a result, they had to come before they were expected to go to work. You'll only be worshiping together when it's dark, if we follow in the current trends. Christians, if you need an image to seize on, think about it this way, all right? And I know this is a stretch, but think of every Lord's Day as a whale. And think of every time that you go out to eat or to shop, or to play Little League, think of that as an explosive harpoon. Okay? And you may say, okay, it's just one whale and one harpoon. But enough whales and enough harpoons, and we've run out of whales. Okay? We are going towards extinction. Finally, let me give you this. Some people, all right, do not find the Lord's Day a delight merely because they've never tried it. They've never tested it. They've never seen it. If you're a Christian and you've never kept the Lord's Day, I would encourage you, brothers and sisters, try this as an experiment. It will be difficult at first because it is a radical change from your habits. Try keeping it. And then pray, Lord, if this is what I'm supposed to do, bless this day to me. And I guarantee you, it will be a blessing to your family. I can give you almost a 100% assurance. Now, there is another way that people don't find the day to be a blessing, and that is they don't find it to be a delight because they don't know the Lord of the Sabbath. It will never be a blessing to you if you don't know Christ. If you aren't this day a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, if you don't know him by faith, then all it can ever be is a legalistic and impossible drudgery. You will never be able to keep it. There is not one commandment, as a matter of fact, that you can even begin to keep unless you know the man who kept them all perfectly on your behalf. Unless you know the Lord Jesus Christ, all of the commandments will be onerous to you. Let me leave you with this then. John Elias, the great Welsh evangelist, said this, and Elias did all that he could to encourage Sabbath observance, even encouraging people to send petitions to Parliament about keeping the Sabbath day holy. He said, "The Sabbath is properly termed the queen of the other days, and we may say that faith, hope, and love are her companions and servants. The gates of her palace are open. She invites all her subjects to her presence and bountifully offers to satisfy all their wants. The Sabbath continues the same, though the ceremonial laws have been abolished. Various comparisons in their great abundance cannot set forth the full value of the Sabbath to nations, churches, subjects, or particular persons. It is the memorial of the creation of the world and the remembrance of the resurrection of Christ. It is the ordinance of our God and the court day of our King. It is the seal of the covenant and sign of our profession, the castle of the kingdom, the feast of the church, the shield of the commonwealth. It is an almoner to the poor, a refuge to the weary, a teacher to the child, a guardian to the youth, a comforter to the old, a touchstone of obedience to the professor, a day of jubilee on earth, the forerunner and shadow of heaven." And he closed with this, "We ought therefore to defend it as most valiant soldiers who, when in possession of their stronghold, will strive for every inch of the land against those who attack them. If the truths of religion are valuable, then the day for teaching them is important. If religion is good to bridle, her commandments to guide, her promises to support, then the Sabbath is of great value. If the public worship of God is to be supported, his word to be read and preached, the sacraments to be administered, Sunday schools to be maintained, then the Sabbath is very delightful and valuable. Let us bless God for this day and pray more to him that he may pour out his Holy Spirit to work powerfully by the means we use on the Sabbath till infidelity and irreligion are made to blush and put to flight." Brothers and sisters, I read those words and I am moved and chastened. I pray that you will be too, to keep the Sabbath holy. Now, I can't force you to do it. All I can do is encourage you to do it, to tell you that it is a blessing, and to warn you, as I have done, of what will happen when it goes away. But remember, brothers and sisters, this day should be a delight to your soul, and I pray that it will be.